personnel policy for the agency. Okay. Also, I was working on a salary study that I had mentioned, which was very difficult. I knew what needed to be done, and when I found inequities, okay, I took it upon myself to go ahead and correct those inequities. Okay. I ran into difficulty because some of the department heads challenged whether or not I should go over there and make these corrections without going through them. Well, hell, they created it. They created it by giving raises to their friends and to their white counterparts, man, and not giving them to other minorities. Okay, blatant. Hiring, you know, I had from the governor that to achieve certain affirmative action goals, you know, when they came in and they didn't even hire, I mean, didn't even interview any minorities, I sent them back. Okay. And if I looked and found a minority that had superior credentials, I hired them over there, okay? Because I had the backing from the governor's office to do that, and I had to make reports to them, okay? Well, you know, they didn't particularly like that. So, you know, I hired a number. You know, I questioned them. I sent them back. I told them, I want you to interview this person. Okay. You know, you give me a report, you know, why you hired this person with less education, less experience over this other person that was minority. I mean, it just showed up blatant. They were hiring their friends, you know. So, which meant that I had some power, okay? And they knew that I had power, and they knew that I was in with the governor's office. They didn't want no trouble, okay? So therefore, I did have some power, and I made them adhere to it. That's the way that we got very qualified people into that agency, okay? And once they got in there, they were very glad that they were there. And I was sending notices to them, man, yo, next time we hire, you really need to look at this area, you know. And if they didn't, you know, I just sent them back and held it up until they put the best qualified person in. Salary study. I went and took care of people, man, who had been discriminated against and salary raises and so forth. I brought them up to the level that the job criteria says that they should be at, and they were below that. Okay. Well, they disliked that. What gives Ed the right man to? And I said, if you read the salary study, it says that anybody that had previously been denied raises should be brought to this level. Okay. And I did that. So my boss, they went to my boss, and he called me in, you know, and I said, now wait, we had an agreement. You read your salary study. We had an agreement that wherever I found any inequities, then I had the right to bring them to that level. And that's what I did. Okay. He said, yeah, I guess, yeah, I do remember something like that, you know. My father got sick. I had ridden the family and was sick, and can't think of the name policy that the government put in. In other words, the federal government says we give you 11 weeks of family medical leave. if you have sickness in your family. I wrote the policy, okay? And I wrote the policy by the guidelines, so I knew the policy, and I put it in, okay? My father got sick, I took family medical leave, and he wasn't there. I couldn't ask him if I could have family medical leave. I gave myself family medical leave.
The executive director was?
No, he wasn't there. And I left him a memo saying that I'm out on family medical leave. My father's terminal. Okay. When he came back, I called him. Told him I had to leave. Okay. I hated to do it this way, but then, you know, judging from what I felt that I needed to do, you know, I did. I don't think that he, I don't think that bothered him that much, because I did try to say that I tried to get in touch with him. Well, I was working on the policy, personnel policy manual, and it was just about ready to be adopted. I was working on the salary study. I had a consultant. It was ready to be adopted. By the consultant and myself, it was a very good document. We worked very hard on that. When I came back after 11 weeks, nothing had been done. Okay. The moment I walked, you know, after my father's death, man, I walked in there and they converged on me. You know, where's the salary study? Where's this? Where's that? Well, I'm grieving. Okay. You know, I mean, I just couldn't gear up the way that they wanted me to. Everything was just left for me until I came back. I tried to work, Bob. I worked on small stuff. And I could not work on these salary schedules, I mean, studies and whatever. I just didn't. I just couldn't do it. So to get back in it, I worked on small stuff, got that out the way, that sort of thing. And I just said to myself, I don't need this, okay? I don't need this. Let me back up and say, when he came, I made sure I didn't spend no money. I saved money. I had me a financial advisor here. We met periodically, and I said to him, if I left today, you know, how long could I work before I could find another job? Until just before I left, he said, well, Ed, you can go for 2 years or you don't need the job. I knew that at 60, I could take early retirement. Okay. So I went in. You know, but I just felt I couldn't take this anymore. I had an agreement with my father that I would take early retirement if I could, take care of my mother who had health problems, you know, and her health was deteriorating. So I told him, I said, look, that was November, first of November I went in. I said, Bob, I'm retiring, I'm leaving, okay, just out of the blue. His comment was to me, can you retire? Do you have enough money to retire? I laughed like that and I said, hey, you know, if you notice, I ain't spent no money since you've been here, okay? I've been driving an 11-year-old car. I work real hard, I don't get a chance to spend no money. You have caused me to save money, you know, just in fact, we didn't get along very well. Yes, I can retire, you know. And he said, well, I thought that a fellow by the name of Jim Quinn would be able to retire before you would have. I said, well, if you look at it, Bob, Jim Quinn just bought a new house, he got a mortgage, okay? Jim Quinn went and bought a beach house. He got a mortgage on that. Jim ain't gonna be able to retire in a long time, okay? All you need to do is just sort of think. I ain't spent no money for them. Okay. Drive 11-year-old car. Okay. You drive an old car. If I had bought a new car, I would have trouble with you. Okay. Yeah, I'm retired. You know. I said, well, but, you know, it's going to be the first of the year. I'm just not going to walk out on you. I'll finish these projects that I got. Salary study, personnel manual, whatever. And, it, you know, I'll try to make sure that we get things up to where I can leave. Which I did. Okay. I was very well thought of by the majority of the employees. They gave me a retirement party, okay, and they just sort of planned it. I had my mother there, I had Esther there, you know, and these were the people that wanted to, in their own special way, say goodbye to me. But he never showed up, okay, he didn't show up. And that sent a message to me, okay? I mean, he could have graciously found some way. He just said, I have something else to do, which was all right. Because I had a lot of fun with the people, man, and I saw who came and who were my friends and that sort of thing. The agency said that they wanted to give me a retirement something during the day, okay, where they had hors d'oeuvres and drink and that sort of thing. I told them I wasn't coming. I'm not coming to this thing, okay. And so they begged me, you know, the people that were putting it on. Bob wants us to do this, and I said, I'm not coming, okay? They had contacted my friend in South Carolina, John Hipshaw. He and his daughter was coming up. That's the only reason I went to that thing, okay? But, you know, I just felt in my heart that, you know, why should I go to this thing? This thing is phony. All these people in here grinning and carrying on and saying all these nice things about me, it really didn't make that much difference. But John came in, you know.
Your tennis buddy, Clemson.
Yeah. And his daughter, John really thinks he's my brother. Okay. His mother thinks he's my brother. Okay. His daughter calls me her uncle. She come in and she, Joe, you know, and hugs me and whatever. And, you know, people are astounded. You know, who is this white fella and his daughter coming in, driving all the way from South Carolina just to be here at my retirement thing. And they had to tell me that John Hipshaw was coming. I wasn't going to this thing. So I went through that, but you know, I left. And best decision I ever made, you know. I can go back over, talk to him, you know, but it's still that something there that will always sort of be there. So you know, going back, Bob. You know, it's always been a problem for me of knowing whether, how much to do my best and that sort of thing. But I've always been determined, I'm not going to fail. You're not going to set me up to fail, okay? So.
Sounds like you had a long period of time where you had conflict with the executive director. Well, what do you think was the cause of the conflict?
I think it was the fact that I had been in the position and everybody had said to him, oh, Ed just did a marvelous job, you know, in that position. I thought that was a threat. I do feel that was his problem, because it was not just me. The executive director that I took over from, he changed everything that he had put in place. Okay. So he wanted to be the person is that, well, it was almost like the agency only started until he got there. There were many people that made contributions to that program to get it the way it was. So the other executive director just happened to be gone. Okay. But everything that he had done, he changed. Okay. He changed some very good things. You know, the person was very smart, you know.
So do you think this was a personality conflict more than an ethnic or racial or black-white issue?
I think the black-white thing had a lot to do with it. Okay. I felt that he didn't feel that a black ought to be, well, receiving praises and so forth from people and musicians of power.
You shouldn't be as confident as you were.
That's right. But, you know, I felt Bobby wasn't going to like me anyway. I may as well be as confident as I can be. And that's what I did. He made assignments to me that he thought I couldn't do. I did a little breeze. I knew a lot of people. Okay. Workshops and so forth that I brought in. The one that probably helped me most of all was we were required to do a workshop on diversity, you know, from the governor's office. Everybody in government is supposed to have this diversity workshop. Okay. So I knew who was out there, who was good, and that sort of thing. So I brought a guy, he was excellent. He was good. He was black, but he was very, very good. Okay. It caused the executive director to look at things that he had been doing, you know, that was obvious, or could be construed as racial. You know, and it helped him. And when he left that workshop, he said, this has been very good for me. I expect everybody else to come in here and get as much from that. So he set the direction for everybody else. Because if he had not, I don't think that the others would have, you know, given it their full divided attention.
So you're saying, in a way, you helped change his outlook toward black people?
Mm-hmm. He was from Detroit. He has stereotypic ideas of what blacks and other minorities were. He had stereotype ideas of what Southerners were like. Okay. Slow, stupid, that sort of thing. He felt anybody came from the north was very bright, anybody from the south, suspect. Okay. I think after being here, I don't think he wants to go back north. Okay. He's lived a pretty good life here. Okay. But, you know, he and his wife invited us out, I guess, at Christmas time. You know, kind of felt like I really didn't feel very comfortable being there. That might be me, but I just sort of felt that. You know, being in his home, I didn't feel that. I have a sense, you know, built up over the years. I can go into a situation and feel reading reactions or whatever, whether or not people are just sort of being gracious. I can tell who's a friend, who's not. Okay. So I just sort of felt like, you know, they just sort of had us there, whatever. He played tennis. Bob, you knew I wasn't going to let him beat me playing tennis. He tried his best. He just did not have the skills that I had playing tennis. I'd been playing tennis for a while, you know. So he learned, and we started playing doubles. I mean, I carried him out of tennis club and beat the dogs out of him. You know, I mean, I taunted him, man. Maybe that was wrong. Maybe my life would have been better. But then when we started to play doubles, you know, he always made sure I was his partner. You know. But, you know, I've been playing tennis for a while. You know, as I said, man, I play social tennis, but I can psych myself up to play well, you know. So he always gave me credit for being a good tennis player, you know. I think that it was a mistake inviting him to the Chapel Hill Tennis Club. I should have taken him to the public courts. I think just coming to the tennis club and seeing the respect and whatever people at the tennis club and what they thought, I think kind of made him say, well, who is this guy?
Let's jump to the tennis club for a second, because I feel you're making a statement here. Here was a man who didn't seem to give you great respect, who saw you as a northerner, and you're a southerner and black. And there seems to be a lack of respect for what you could do, and a jealousy. And contrast this with how you were seen at the tennis club. How did white people see you at the tennis club, and why do you think they saw you that way?
I had a difficult time, Bob, deciding whether or not I was going to join the tennis club and be a member. I borrowed the $300 from my father. But I had said to him, I'm ambivalent about joining this club. They seem sincere in wanting me to be a member, but I don't want to be a member. I want to be a token black out there. I don't want to pay to join something, man, that I'm going to be discriminated against. I said that to Bill Blackburn. Okay. Bill assured me that it wouldn't be that way as long as he was president and whatever. So I joined. I will have to say to you, that's the best $300-some I ever spent in my life. Okay, from the very moment that I went in, they treated me with respect. They treated me as just another person that joined the tennis club. I don't know if it's the quality of people that play tennis or what. I said to you that I didn't play very well when I first started. I wasn't a tennis player. I played baseball, but I was learning to play tennis. When I got to play with Mack McKinney, okay, on the doubles court, and Mack accepted me as a doubles tennis player, and I felt I had arrived, okay? And Mack let it be known that he had put the Good House stamp of approval on me. And Mac, everybody respected Mac to the extent that I was all right.
Now Mac was a businessman in Chapel Hill?
And one of the founders of the tennis club.
Was he, would you consider him a redneck or a liberal?
No, I wouldn't. He wasn't a liberal and he wasn't a redneck. He was Mac. That's the only way I know Mac. Mac, he just didn't bestow his approval on you. You had to prove yourself as a tennis player for him to accept you. He wouldn't play with you, man, if you just didn't play with everybody, we'll just put it that way. He was just sort of discriminating as to who he considered good tennis players and whatever. Mac accepted me in that club. Bob Boyce, always been a friend. And I've had just unbelievable number of people that was very friendly, went out of their way to play with me. I think the thing that impressed me most was that they played with my son, okay? We had matches, man, where father-son played against another father-son. But there were people in that club that took my son and developed his tennis skills. They played with him and that sort of thing. There were incidents where people came in from the north or somewhere else and had said to me, that was one lady in particular that had said to me, I should be happy that they let me be a member of the tennis club being black. Okay? She was from the north. She thought that she had hot shot tennis skill, and she was a good player. And everybody sort of made over her, but she had said that to me. And I came back at her and said, well, how long have you been a member of this club? And she said, something like a year. And I said, well, hell, I've been here 10 years. Okay. How much you pay for dues? She told me, I said, well, you know, I play the same amount. Why should I feel lucky to be a member of the club? I think you ought to feel lucky. I've been in this damn club longer than you've been in here, okay? I pay the same amount of dues you pay, okay? You should feel very lucky that I accept you in this tennis club because I've been in here much longer than you have, you know? I've been here from the very beginning. And I let her know. people that were standing around sort of laughed, okay? Man, it got her. I had no more problem. Now that may come across as being kind of arrogant, but that's pretty much the way I've always done. I had served on the board of directors before I served as president. I was treasurer of the club. Okay. The club was in the red. All kinds of things, man. I'd had a lot of administrative experiences in my jobs. So as treasurer, I put restrictions on who could go down to files and purchase. Okay? You need a purchase order to go down there and purchase. Okay? I put restrictions on the president at that time. He was spending money, man, like it was his. He wasn't coming to the board. He was just spending it. Okay? I understood, man, that he had lost his wife and he was going through a grieving process, but he was spending the money, man, without even checking with anybody. So I put dampers on it. Okay. I put dampers on the tennis pro. They were walking into the snack bar. You know, all the lifeguards were eating lunch free, and he was eating lunch free, and all his pros were eating lunch. And I said, from this day on, the snack bar is going in a hole. If you, anything you get in here, you buy, okay? No more free food for pool people or tennis people, Everybody paid. If I got to pay, you pay. That was Jim Haslam. Jim ain't like me from that day on. Jim Haslam, we didn't have a manager at the time. The pro was the manager. We had a person by the name of Willie Davis. I don't know if you remember. He was black. He was amputee, whatever. I had talked Willie into leaving his job at Fraternity House to come work for the tennis club. Okay, Willie worked hard. Willie was out there working, man, trying to keep those courts and so forth. Willie was unstopping sewer problems and wasn't his job, man. He was doing these things. Well, Haslam gave all his pros and everybody out there a raise and didn't give Willie one. Okay. He brought this thing to a board of directors meeting, and I looked at it. You know, we had some people, man, that were college kids, man. I said, Haslam, you're using Willie's truck, man, to haul stuff and do whatever, and you don't give him no money as compensation. I know that for a fact. Everybody here got a raise but Willie, okay? I suggest you go back. And no, gonna be no raises until such time as you, number one, start compensating him for the use of his truck, and you need to come back where he gets a raise too. I see him out here working, man, when nobody else is working. And this is unfair. Okay. We stopped speaking. But Willie got a raise like the rest of them. Okay. Al Thomas came in as president. Al fired Willie. Okay. So what'd you fine for? Let me see his performance evaluation, Al. Okay. Al took the word, we at that time hired a manager, and this manager didn't like Willie for whatever reason. Okay. And I said, well, Al, there's a personnel problem, personality problem there. I know the manager wants to bring somebody in. I knew who he wanted to bring in. It was a fella named Nunn. Nunn had a lot of skills, but you just don't fire somebody, man, for no particular reason. So I told Al, I said, you got a real problem, okay? I'm not gonna let you fire Willie, okay? Because I know Willie, I grew up with Willie, I know all his children, okay? I got to walk in this community, man. Unless you can show me something on his performance evaluation that says you need to, that he's not performing, then okay. But other than that, you're gonna reinstate him. Al never, I don't think Al has ever seen anybody that strong with him, okay? Especially being black, you know. I said, Al, man, I have all kind of civil rights people in here. Put Willie back. Al knew that I was political. Al didn't know who I knew. Okay, he said it's a private club, and I said you want to test it. You put Willie back on the payroll. Okay, you give him the kind of performance evaluations. Okay, he did, and I would have to say the best feeling I've ever had was when Willie was a double amputee. Still trying to work, and they took up money to retire his mortgage from that club, man. That's just how much they thought of Willie, okay? That made me feel extremely good. But there were times and so forth that things like that. Jim Haslam has nothing to say to me today. And Jim Haslam was very instrumental in helping Ed develop, because I sent him to his first camp with Jim. And Jim did a good job, you know. But there's a right, and there's a wrong. Now, when they came to me and asked me if I would consider being president? I told him, yeah, because I was the only one really that had the time, excuse me, to do it. I was retired. What I did was clear my calendar of other organizations that I was in to be president. Okay. And I was determined that I was going to do the best job that I knew how to do. I knew that we needed a personnel manual. You know, we needed to run that place like a business. Things that you and others had put in place, man, were forgotten, filed somewhere, weren't being followed, and that sort of thing. So, you know, they hired a fellow named Tom Martin. Okay. I knew from the very beginning that I was going to have problems with Tom. Okay. Tom thought that he had hired, that I was going to be a figurehead. Okay. But my personality says, man, I'm not going to be no figurehead. If you're going to elect me president, I'm going to be president. Okay? I'm going to do the best job as president that I can do. I read the bylaw. I understood what was supposed to, I was supposed to do, and that's what I was going to do. And we had a clash almost from the beginning. Tom told me that I should be beholden to him because he had gotten me elected president. And I said, I thought the membership elected me. Okay. Now, you may have suggested to me that I ought to run. The membership elected me. Okay. Now, Tom, you don't know me very well. Okay. I have a reputation in this community. I have a reputation at the club. I've received letters from people in the club that have a lot of faith in me. I'm going to do what I'm supposed to do. Okay. And we're going to have problems, which we did. From the very beginning, we had problems. I'm quoting the bylaws, and he's wanting to sign checks. He was signing stuff, and he was hiring people that didn't come to the board. He just took power and ran the club. And I wrestled, man, with him to gain power back. He fired somebody, man. He was putting people in that was his friends, stuff, you know. He was hiring young ladies and so forth and calling his harem, you know, stuff. You know, and I felt very uneasy, you know, with this man and how he was operating. So I just got to start to get strong, okay. So we clashed. He started treating the staff, man, intimidating them, threatening them with their job. And I was telling him, no, you don't have anything to worry about. Okay. He can't fire you without coming to the board. Okay. And we had some knockdown, drag out sessions. Okay. I think Tom was afraid of me. I don't know if he had heard the stereotypes, man, that blacks are violent and whatever, but Tom was afraid of me. Okay. Tom had Lou Shook. Anything he wanted to say to me, he said it through Lou.
So he stopped talking to you?
Yes. And I told Lou, don't deliver no messages to me. Okay. Tom is the manager. I'm the president. Okay. We will adhere according to the bylaws. Don't you come to me with no more messages. Tom has something to say to me, he pick up the phone or he talk to me. Okay. And poor Lou, Tom just had him doing things. We met at the Carolina coffee shop to try to resolve some of these differences. Lou was supposed to be the mediator. Man, we lit that place up. Okay. I mean, I got loud in there. Okay. The you know, and I just said, I am not backing up. I'm going to do what I think is right. And, you know, this is the way it's going to be. I said, Lou, you can't mediate this. You can't mediate the bylaws. You can't mediate what I think that I'm supposed to do. I'm going to do what I think is right. So we left there to agree to disagree. Because I went back and home. Lou always tried to mediate. Okay, and I was putting things in writing. I sent him a memo of things that of the way we were going to operate. Okay. This man had said derogatory terms about women, members that I consider friends. He just wasn't a good person. He said somebody was gay and stuff, and I said, man, don't say that. You don't say that around me. I'm going to make this public to the membership. I just will not be a part of this character assassination that you're doing. Because if you didn't agree with him, he assassinated you. We got to the place, man, that one day I really started to, tongue was short, guy, okay? I had to do everything to restrain myself when he started picking on the women. And I said to Anita's husband, could you let this man do this to your wife, okay? I'd stop him. Why would you allow him to do that to your wife? I would never allow nobody to do that to my wife.
What was it?
Oh, he had intimidated her, say he was going to fire her, and all this kind of stuff, man. He really just did a mind job on her. So, we got to a place we really could work. I think Tom felt that he had the power. He kept meetings all messed up. He's a very bright man. Don't ever underestimate his intelligence. Very bright. He knew he was a very good speaker. He'd come to the meetings, he could talk long, whatever, keep things tied up. He said things so eloquently, he was believable. Okay. We didn't ever have a good meeting. See, if he wanted to keep something tied up, he tied it up. We tried for 3 months to adopt a personnel manual, and we had Leanne Neese, who was an attorney, and that's her field of expertise with the law firm, personnel policies and labor relations and so forth. And she had gone through the personnel manual and made sure that it was, could be defended in court and stuff. Had a good manual. Couldn't get it adopted in 3 months. Kept it tied up. So he, one meeting, he grandstanded. Audience there. He said all these derogatory things about me, and I didn't respond. So I was not going to diminish who I was to get into that kind of discussion. He walked out. He did a grandstand. He walked out the meeting. As soon as he walked out, Bob, I put that personnel manual up and we adopted it. You know. We're still in litigation. There are things I'm not really supposed to say about it. And he's not a good person.
I remember well.
Not a good person. but club-wise, it made me feel extremely good of the support that I had. And at that meeting, people turned out, you know, it got to be between Ed and Tom. And Tom misread that. And I think Tom felt that him being white, me being black, that they would support him. That's the only thing that I could figure out. When he came in at that annual meeting, he saw the turnout, and he had Lou Shook getting up and heavily and his hench people supporting him. And he had Elliot Crame on him. He won't Elliot Crame on me for nothing in the world. That he saw him writing on the wall and he resigned. Okay. I felt very good at that. I had really been beaten down. I was emotional, beat down. And I was glad that the annual meeting was there so I could ride off into the sunset. You know, man, I